My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagrids, and we're back with the Western Bubble Podcast. Today, we're talking about the third part of our three-part episodes on institutional decline, with a focus on how attractive is the West actually still after years and years of managerial attitudes and other problems that we've discussed in the past two episodes. However, before we talk about today's topic, it's actually very important for us personally that we actually tell you about two corrections that were sent in by listeners to us. As you know, we always ask for you to provide us with feedback and also corrections. And here are two cases that are very important. The first one is a little bit older, and we've been aware of this for quite some time. And this one happened in episode 18 on neocolonialism, which makes it, I think, especially embarrassing. But Balder, in this episode, you accidentally called South Sudan as part of Southern Africa.
Yes, that is incredibly embarrassing, Dario. And I listened back to it, at least to two of those instances, so it wasn't just once. And it made it sound as if we as Europeans don't actually know much about geography in Africa. I've worked in South Sudan. I've been there multiple times. And I'm very much aware that South Sudan is not part of Southern Africa. It's part of the Sahel region, right? Very much Central Africa in that sense. And I apologize. Sometimes we record and then the brain just breaks, I guess. We record without a script and we just blab throughout these episodes, and then these things happen. So apologies for anyone who was confused by that. South Sudan is absolutely not Southern Africa, and I have no idea why I said that in the first place.
Well, and I mean, somehow our brains also didn't pick up on that when we listened back to the episode, right, which we always do before publishing. But it's such a quick little thing that can quickly come in, right? Southern Africa, Sahel, yeah.
Yes, Sub-Saharan Africa, South Sudan. It was episode 18. It's a very long time ago, but it is just something that the brain must have, confused. Some wires were crossed with the word South and Sub-Saharan and all that. But obviously, South Sudan is not Southern Africa. My apologies.
And in another episode where we made a mistake is in episode 76 on the UK's Rwanda policy. And listener Beatrice Tonin wrote us an email and said, "The UK is not the first Western nation to send asylum seekers elsewhere. Australia has been doing offshore processing since 2001, sending asylum seekers to neighboring islands such as Christmas Island, Nauru, Manus, and Papua New Guinea." Exactly spot on, right? And that's also a bit embarrassing, because right before we recorded an episode with our good friend Dan Bloch on Australia. But sometimes, right, just these things kind of slip your mind, because I remember actually reading about this a few years ago very intensely about Australia and it's basically scaring off tactic, but somehow we didn't talk about it in the episode.
Well, and in this case, it might also be a sign of just ignorance on our part, right? So even though we may have read something about it in the past, it's very clear that our knowledge is much greater about Europe and about maybe the United States than it is about Australia. And so here, we thought, hey, Europe has never done this kind of thing. So therefore, it has not happened yet, which is exactly the Western bubble, like Eurocentric thinking, as if Europe is the standard for everything happening, right? So also pretty embarrassing. And many thanks to Beatrice for pointing this out.
See, and so these are just two examples of basically many emails we receive with feedback. I mean, it's not always as striking as this. This is the reason why we only correct it when we're talking about, these two examples. So feel free, like all the listeners, please feel free to continue sending us emails correcting us, even if we will not always announce it publicly on the episode. We always acknowledge your feedback. We're very grateful for your feedback, and we're very much looking forward to all future feedback that you will be sending to us. With this, let's move on to today's episode, and let's hope that today we will not be making any mistakes that need to be corrected. As I said at the very beginning, we are today in our third part of our three-part, basically, episode construct on institutional decline within the West and institutional failure. So in the past episodes, we've talked about universities in particular, and then the other episode was on foreign policy. And today we want to talk, we're a bit kind of concluding these thoughts on the West's attractiveness to the outside world. Walter, why are we talking about this topic today?
Well, essentially, it comes down to us being blinded to decline, decay inside of our own societies. And that is very clearly visible in our relationship with outsiders who want to come in, right? So we still walk around with this belief that there are enormous masses of people who just desperately want our way of life, who want to share in our societal success, whereas the rest of the world is becoming very skeptical looking at our societies, at our political systems, at our institutional failures, and saying, you know, maybe I can still make some money by going to Western Europe. Maybe I can earn a living by going to the United States. But as countries, they are nowhere near as attractive as maybe they seem to be 30, 40 years ago. And in many ways, that kind of analysis of how does an outsider look at us is a really good indicator of how well we're doing, right? If everyone believes that you are the promised land, then that's probably a sign that something is going well. If people become more skeptical and negative about what you look like from their perspective, then that's probably a sign that something is rotten in the Kingdom of Denmark.
And what are the facts?
So usually this is where we would continue with the fact sheet, where I provide some context on a case study or read out some hard data on the topic of the day. However, with this episode, there's simply so many data points and so many statistics, as our researchers pointed out to us, that it really depends on what question you ask. And therefore, we will basically be cherry picking the data that we will be kind of highlighting throughout the episode, which means that building up on the little feedback or kind of correction part we had at the beginning of this episode, please, dear listeners, if you feel like we kind of missed some data points or there's anything else that maybe contradicts our statements, feel free to send them to thewesternbubble@gmail.com.
What is the bubble?
So now let's start with today's basically analysis of this topic. And let's, when we're talking about is the West still an attractive place to be at or to go to, it makes sense to focus on migration and migration in general. However, we first need to define what is migration, right? Because there's different types of migration and they all deserve to be looked at. Let's first focus at three categories of why people voluntarily come to other countries. And at the end, we'll kind of highlight a fourth category where people are maybe not as voluntarily leaving their home countries. So starting with the three voluntary reasons, the first one is, as you already mentioned before, economic reasons, right? I mean, maybe it's a lot more attractive to be working in another country to make a lot more money.
Yeah, and that's the traditional reason. Most people look at their own societies, their own homes, where they were born, where they grew up, with a lot of happiness and warmth. But sometimes those societies do not give the financial benefits that you might find elsewhere. And then people migrate in order to provide for their children, to send money back home, for their children to have a better life, etc., etc. So that is the economics, financial reasons, just saying, hey, here, there's unemployment in my country, and if I find a job, the income is very low, therefore I will travel to, let's say, Switzerland, or I will travel to a rich country that gives me opportunities, even though I've got no particular emotional attachment to Switzerland or any of those other countries.
And then there's the second group of people, and that's you, right? So it's people who just prefer to live in another country because of the hours of sun and the coffee in the country.
And the tapas. So I live in Spain, not for financial reasons, because I could do what I'm doing in the Netherlands as well. But I really enjoy living here in Spain. And my wife and I had a conversation and we basically said, where do we want our child to grow up? And we thought, well, Spain is a very pleasant, kind place to grow up for a young child because it is socially safer than, if you like, Northern Europe. It is generally kinder, the sun, the culture, everything. So that's purely because I think that Spain has something preferable to, in my case, the Netherlands.
And then the third group here is basically your the host country that you're migrating to, actively seeking your migration. So this could be a pretty common topic nowadays is basically skilled workers in the medical sector, right? So nurses, for example, or doctors. And here sometimes countries will say, oh, here in Cuba, there's a lot of very skilled young doctors. Why don't you come here and we'll actually make your migration easier. We'll pay for your plane ticket. We'll make sure that the visa application goes through quickly. Right, so that's basically the third reason why is that someone is actively seeking your migration.
Indeed. And what you see in the West is that politically, it's still probably acceptable to make the case for skilled migration, because that sounds sort of more positive. Whereas in reality, the West also is in need of unskilled labor, a lot of it, even just within the fruit sectors or within baggage handling at airports, etc., etc. There's a lot of need for unskilled labor, but it's politically not as acceptable as before because we have somehow decided that immigrants are a threat. Whereas in the 1960s, this was a very clear policy. Like I'm here in Spain, originally from the Netherlands, but in the 60s in Germany and the Netherlands, a lot of Spanish migrants went there to work at relatively low-paying jobs. And that was a clear, active policy by the German and Dutch governments to attract these workers migrants. It's just that nowadays in 2024, the only way to make the case for migration somehow is to say, oh, these are really brilliant people that are really going to make our society better. Because the tides have shifted in terms of our tolerance towards outsiders, if you like.
Mm-hmm. And then, as I mentioned, there's a fourth group of people, but for them, it's not as voluntary. Here we're talking about asylum seekers or refugees, right? So they are usually emigrating from their country because of war or because of persecution in any way, shape or form. And I mean, for this conversation, we'll kind of take them out because their reasons for choosing to go to the West are not connected to, oh, it's there will be such great opportunities, but it's more like, oh, this is where I will not be killed.
And also the policies that exist, right? So the West has traditionally, even though it's becoming worse and worse, traditionally has been relatively open to refugees and asylum seekers, whereas other countries are much less open. So then the conversation would be about the legal system surrounding it, which has very little to do with the happiness or institutions of the society itself. I would argue, and with that we'll move on from there, but I would argue that the fact that we are becoming less and less kind towards asylum seekers and refugees is a sign of a society that is becoming fearful and negative and, you know, not something to be particularly proud of.
Mm. Yeah, and probably also one of the reasons why, I mean, maybe people want to migrate less towards the West for voluntary reasons, but we'll get more into this in a few minutes. Because let's first talk about the overall image of the West within the world, right? I mean, again, I wasn't alive 30, 40 years ago when, I mean, the West was basically at its peak, right? We always talk about the 1990s here. So I can't really speak to feelings of people everywhere in the world towards the West and how great it might be to move to the United States and live the American dream. To move to Europe, and I don't know if there's a European dream, right? But people looked up to the West, because also the West saw itself as the shining light on the hill.
Yes, interestingly enough, already in the 90s, but certainly in the 21st century, the American dream basically exists nowadays in Europe and is basically dead in the United States, right? If you define the American dream as social mobility, the ability for someone to start at a relatively low level and then make something out of their lives and become financially successful, those chances are way higher in, let's say, Scandinavia than in the United States. But the fact that we call the American dream says something about the image that the United States had. Now, that doesn't mean that the world was not critical of the United States in the past. People have always been critical of the United States and Europe because of neocolonial reasons, and the United States because it's a superpower and superpowers do stupid stuff, Vietnam and others. So it's not as if people were in love with the United States, but overall, there was a very clear image of, in the United States, my life can be better than it is at home, not just for financial reasons, but also because it's a fair country where if I work hard, I make something out of my life, that American dream thing. If I go there, I will be free from religious persecution. I will have political stability. Those kinds of things absolutely existed and were one of the reasons why the United States became the superpower it is today. The waves of immigrants from Italy and elsewhere in the late 19th, early 20th century led to a country that was dynamic and that basically provided hope for those who were hopeless at home, right? And that image now is completely gone. People don't look at the United States as the country of hope. They don't look at Europe as a place that is infinitely better than their own home country. No, the United States and Western Europe are places where income per capita is still relatively high, where there are some good things, but it is no longer a clear-cut case.
And the data, right, that we've cherry-picked also backs us up, is where perception of particularly the United States, but also of Europe, has decreased in kind of like global outlook onto these places. And I assume that a lot of the things that we talk about in other episodes, which are problematic within the West, have a lot to do with this, right? So polarization, lack of trust in institutions, let's be honest, the foreign policy, what we talked about last week, also doesn't help. I mean, we see a big dip in kind of global perception of the United States in 2003 with the second Iraq war. Then it kind of climbs back up, right? Yay, Obama. But then throughout the last 10 years, we just see it plummeting in most countries. And then there are some outliers that still see the United States in very good terms.
And that's the consequence of institutions that are essentially failing, right? And so people from the outside know quite a lot about the United States, especially maybe Europe a little bit less, but anyone living in India or China or Nigeria or South Africa or Brazil, they all know some basic facts about the United States and they get some news about the United States. And the world is looking at how institutions are disrespected in the United States, how institutions are failing. And they're saying, hang on, is that a country that has a long-term future ahead of it? If I go there, am I actually going to improve my life? Or am I going to be caught up in some kind of civil war between conservatives and liberals in that country? Do institutions still function? I see a government that is crumbling, that is completely underfunded. I see a legal system that is under threat from its own president, or former president, etc., etc. And people know that about the United States. They see that and they say, okay, maybe I will go there for 10 years to make some money, but I am not so sure whether it's better than Brazil or Nigeria or South Africa, which are also countries with problems, but there's nothing particularly special about the United States, which is very different from what there was 100 years ago. Then the United States absolutely was special. It seemed dynamic. It seemed positive. It seemed a land of hope and opportunity.
I mean, I've brought this up in past episodes, but I'll continue bringing it up today. My very scientific, basically, survey of every time I talk to people my age, but also people of other age groups, on whether they would actually consider raising their kids, their potential kids, in the United States. And 10, 15 years ago, there was a whole different conversation. Right, it was still kind of like, yes, of course, in the United States, right, I can make good money, it's nice and safe, and I can live in my little house, right, with my front yard, and I can sit on the porch and drink lemonade, or, right, like that image that we have of the United States. But it has dramatically shifted in the past few years. And nowadays, I get exactly the response that you just said. Yeah, maybe I'll move there for a few years to make money, right, to kickstart my career, but after that, I want to move elsewhere, right? I mean, usually I hear, right, I want to move back to Europe. So when I talk to Europeans, but I also now hear more and more Americans who say, no, I am genuinely considering moving to Europe because the United States is just no longer that place that it used to be, and the institutions are no longer working in my, like, they're no longer working, but they're also no longer working in my favor. I no longer feel trust in them. I no longer feel trust in the political system. The polarization is at a decrease that is worrying to me. I want to go elsewhere. I want to go places where this is a bit safer.
There's loads of anecdotal evidence from my own life as well. But as a student, when I graduated, I and most people around me kind of seem to know that at some point we wouldn't end up in New York with some apartments in Manhattan, and that would be our future. It was completely clear that we all wanted to go to the United States in the late 90s, in the early, well, very early 2000s, maybe before 9/11, let's say. Now, if you talk to students at universities, they do not have that desire. They do not think that the United States will be their end destination. And I have two friends who actually went to the United States because they had really good job offers, because wages are higher, salaries are higher in the United States than in Europe. The moment they got children, they moved back to Europe because they didn't want their children to grow up in the United States. That is, a lot of that is vague, is basically the image that people have, right? Which is backed up by some facts. You know, if you look at basic statistics of social well-being in the United States, they've been going downhill. But a lot of that is also just a broad sentiment that is then exacerbated by the stories of police brutality. Now, if you travel as a European, if you were to go and live in the United States, the chances of you ever facing police brutality are relatively low, especially if you're white and blonde and in a well-to-do area. But all of those things work to create a rather negative perspective on the United States. And here comes for us as Europeans, the scary part. I think there's a case to be made with many of these kinds of trends that Europe is just 20 years behind the United States. So right now, people want to stay in Europe rather than going to the United States. But soon, Europe will follow that path, right? And will start copying certain dynamics. You already see it with politics. You see it with police violence being up in Europe. Police is becoming more violent over the past 10 years, even though crime hasn't actually gone up in Europe. Those kinds of signs should worry any European, because before you know it, people in India and China will have this conversation like, hey, in the past I was thinking about going to Europe, but now I'm going to go to Brazil or Nigeria instead.
Or, you know, I will definitely go to Europe for, I don't know, maybe a job or for a university, but I would never raise my children there, no.
Indeed, exactly. And we could make a very, very long list of all the different aspects that contribute to that negative vibe, if you like. But the overarching problem is just that institutions no longer are doing their job in the United States and increasingly not in Europe.
Yeah. So the reasons why people want to move to the West are basically 1 in 4 we mentioned, right? So economic reasons, or you're forced to flee from your home country. And you kind of describe that, right, that institutional decline, and to give a better analogy, you brought up an example of a hotel that used to be really cool 30 years ago, but the manager is also the same as 30 years ago, and now it's not as cool anymore.
Yeah, it's a classic example, right? I'm sure that lots of films have been made about this. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but this idea of once, a long time ago, a hotel was at the top of everyone's wish list. It was 5 stars, beautiful architecture, art deco, etc., etc. A young, vibrant management team that did things differently, and people were willing to pay enormous amounts of money to stay in that hotel. Well, that's kind of, you could say, that was Europe and the United States in the 1990s. But then over time, management becomes stale, the manager becomes older, doesn't see how the world is moving on, doesn't see how the world is progressing, and keeps on doing the same things he did in the 1990s, 10 years later, 20 years later, 30 years later, until you're now in 2024, and now the hotel is just a still ghost of its past. And yes, there are still some people who go there because it still has a reputation of its history, but it is no longer as hip, as attractive, as cool as the new hotels. And the manager can't see it because this is the only life and work he's ever done and doesn't really understand why the rest of the world is moving on from him.
Right, and to make matters worse, this manager, instead of seeing his own mistakes, he basically has a young staff. And I don't know, maybe they make a mistake, and now he gets really mad at them and tells them off, without seeing that maybe he or his structures that he set in place are the reason why they are failing.
Yeah, and he has no way of evaluating the new trends that are occurring, doesn't really listen to customers anymore. Those clients that still come into the hotel probably have been there for 30 years and don't know anything, don't know better either. And so you get into this negative spiral of slow decay simply because it's getting out of touch with the rest of the world around the hotel, or in our case, the West, is no longer in touch with the realities of the rest of the world. And this is very visible. We are so confused when South Africa goes to the ICC and actually uses the ICC for an agenda that is not Western. We are so confused when India and China are doing things differently from our way of doing things, but we don't really understand it. We're stuck in the past.
And those are the outsiders that the West needs, right? Because and you've mentioned this at the beginning, right? It's not only highly skilled labor that we need, but it's also, I don't know, a waiter or a waitress in a cafe. You see the signs everywhere. You also basically hear everywhere people, right? We're just lacking labor, and I don't need to tell us about the demographic situation we're in, right? This is not going to get any better in the next 10 years when the boomer generation goes into retirement. So theoretically, the West should be very grateful to migration that comes here, right? So highly skilled labor, but also unskilled labor, because I mean, you do not need a university degree to be a waiter in a cafe, is what I'm saying here. But at the same time, the West doesn't want migration, right? Because there's something, there's something negative about migration and others coming here.
Yeah, this is almost paradoxical, right? It's not quite a paradox, because it's essentially a conflict between reality and reason on the one hand, and on the other hand, sentiments. But the seeming paradox is that Europe and the United States are absolutely in need of that, of those flows of people right now, because we already need jobs. But especially if you look at demographics down the line, in 30, 40 years' time, Europe is facing an enormous demographic crisis with way too many old people and not enough young people. Now, that cannot be solved by in 30 years' time all of a sudden opening the doors. The way to do that is open the doors now to slowly let young people integrate into European society and become a well-functioning part of that society. And yet we are actively, aggressively going against those immigrants, where we need them now and in the future, but we don't want them. So that almost seems paradoxical. And the reason why it's not quite a paradox is the fact that this would be reasonable analysis. What I'm providing you is the truth. This is just based on statistics that we need those people. But over the past 20 years, we've created an environment, a sentiment in which outsiders are a threat, where outsiders somehow are a problem for us. And that's exactly the sign of a society that is decaying, a sign of that hotel manager that doesn't want anyone new with new ideas coming in, that just wants to continue doing the things in the old way. I, in the past, likened the West to an old grumpy retiree, someone who retired 10 years ago, now just wants to keep the young people off his lawn and just really would like to build a big wall around his house and be left alone, not understanding that his well-being is dependent on outside forces and his interaction with outside forces, right? So we now are in a situation that we're shooting ourselves horribly in the foot simply because of an anti-migrant sentiment that is not justified by any reality.
What's the international relations context?
So, because of the reasons that we mentioned, there is a Western decline is foreseeable, right? Particularly economic decline when we're not looking at fixing the problem with the amount of labor we have, aka increasing migration into the West. This allows for other places, other countries, other nations to basically take over, right, from the West. I mean, there's always this big talk about, oh, China might be taking over because, you know, this is also one of the biggest economies in the world. But then we're also looking at India, the most populous country in the world. We're looking at, countries in the Middle East are increasingly becoming more powerful, more settled in their ways. We can look at the BRICS countries, right? So Brazil, Indonesia, Nigeria. these countries could potentially basically fill the gap that the West is leaving behind, which is obviously bad news for the West. But why? Let's talk about why this is such bad news. I mean, why is it bad for the West if basically migrants now go to China instead of the West?
Well, first of all, because we would very much like those migrants, right? It's good to have those migrants, despite our weird underbelly sentiments at the moment about migration. Migration is good for us. But on top of that, the moment that the rest of the world starts connecting with each other and leaves us out, and we do that on purpose, we isolate ourselves, but that means that the rest of the world starts interconnecting with itself. And you see this with the BRICS countries, generally what we sometimes call the Global South, is more and more trading with each other. You see much more migration in between those countries. That means that the rest of the world is creating dynamics, is creating a future, is forging a future that doesn't require the West. And that means that we are becoming less and less relevant over time, which means that we have less and less ability to shape the world in our own image. Now, despite our ranting about democracy and liberalism, you and I quite like democracy and liberalism. And with us isolating our societies from the rest of the world, that means that we will have less opportunity to actually convince the world of our systems and say, hey, you know what? There's actually something valuable here, and maybe you should give it a try, etc., etc., right? So we are basically allowing a future that doesn't require us, and therefore we will not be able to influence it. Generally, diasporas are really good ways. So if you have a large group of migrants from a specific country, are a really good way to connect with that other country. And they're a very good way to somehow make sure that you have relevance to the other country and that there is some interdependency. And that means that your foreign policy, but also your cultural interaction is all going to flourish because of that. Think about the United States with Italy in the past, with Ireland, with Latin America. There's a lot of interaction that really benefits the United States. And if you now have a situation where there's no longer any new diaspora coming in, no new groups coming in, that means that it will be much, much harder for you to connect to the rest of the world.
And can you explain to our listeners what is the problem?
And as we've mentioned before, but now that we're in the category of the damage, this is problematic, right? If the West cannot connect to the rest of the world, if the West is missing out on economic development because it doesn't have the labor it needs. And the worst part of it seems to be that the West is completely unaware of the reasons for this, right? Because, I mean, as we've mentioned, there are efforts by Western countries to attract labor from abroad, right? For very specific jobs, such as in the medical sector. But there's the question, right, of why does nobody want to come to the West to do this voluntarily because we offer such high wages and because, right, we need the jobs there. That question isn't really being asked, right? It's usually about, we just don't have enough nurses. Let's fly in some from Cuba.
Yeah, and this goes hand in hand with our lack of understanding, because then people, maybe some of our listeners to this episode, will say, what are you going on about? There are hundreds of thousands, millions of people every year who apply for visas and all that. Yes, but you're misunderstanding the reason why they apply for those visas. They apply for those visas because they can make some money. They can actually offer their services for a short period of time. They don't come in anymore, at least not in large numbers, because somehow they believe that Europe or the United States are the promised land. And that lack of attractiveness means that we are losing a huge, competitive advantage, of comparative advantage to other countries such as China and India. If people are now looking at the world and says, well, I'm just going to compare wages as a nurse. Can I make money in China or can I make money in the United States? And I'm just going to go with the highest bidder. Then that, of course, means that we can no longer compete on the quality of life. We can no longer compete on the institutions. And that's really, really bad news for us. It also sort of hides the fact, this idea that people in Europe or the United States have, that there are these millions of people desperately wanting to come in, it hides the fact that our institutions are in fact on the decline, that our institutions are no longer as attractive. Basically, by not being able to distinguish the reasons why people migrate to the West, we do not have a mirror to look at ourselves. And we're no longer dynamic. We're no longer self-critical. We're no longer able to actually distinguish one from the other. And that bodes very badly for the Western Empire, if you like.
And I think we cannot underestimate this fact, right? That people are... Because, yes, if I'm your average Joe or your average middle-class person here in Germany, people are coming to Germany all the time, at least, right? I'm seeing this, right? So I remember the Ukrainians, they fled from war. The Syrians, they also fled from war, right? I perceive there to be a huge influx of people at all times. We always see the images from the European borders. So people want to come here, meaning it must be really great, right? And I think that... psychological hurdle almost, I think it's a really difficult one to take, because I mean it's very comfortable to think that there's something that we have that others want, and therefore I think we might need to protect it from the others.
Yeah, so it pulls the wool off our eyes, right? It basically fools us into thinking that we are still doing really, really well, and that is very dangerous. Now think about my situation in Spain. If I didn't come to Spain for financial reasons. Income in the Netherlands is much higher than in Spain. I very specifically came to Spain because I really, really like the country, because there are some things that I find attractive as a foreigner. I would like to think, we can argue about that, but that I generally have a positive impact on my surroundings on Spain. I mean, I don't do anything particularly destructive as far as I'm aware. So... I think that it's a mutually beneficial relationship between myself and the country and the society of Spain. Great. But the moment that Spain loses that attractiveness, then all of a sudden they would have to start competing. And right now it seems as if that's not the case, but it absolutely is becoming the case. Europe as a whole will have to start competing on price, on money, rather than on values or on future hope. Because the institutions aren't working in the way they should anymore, and the rest of the world is improving much faster, is moving on. Not having that image, being fooled into thinking that things are okay, is absolutely destructive to Europe at the moment and to the West in general.
And what now?
And this is not likely to change anytime soon, right? I mean, we see this in election results. We see this in basically migration policy or anti-migration policy. We see this in, the trial of Donald Trump as the most recent example, right, of institutions further declining. We've talked about this last week in the episode on foreign policy, right? Another reason why the West is becoming increasingly unattractive, because they're very destructive, right, on the global stage. And I mean, we've also talked about the internal reasons for that in basically the first part of this three-parter. I usually ask you right about now, Balder, what can we do? Please give us at least some hope in these episodes. However, given that we spent almost 3 hours analyzing the problems of this, I think it would be a little bit ambitious to provide answers within the next 5 minutes. So we said, you know what, at the end of the season, so basically at the end of season 4 of the Western Bubble podcast, we will have one or maybe even two episodes basically full of optimism, because we will be providing solutions on, okay, how do we stop that institutional failure? How do we stop that institutional decline on the domestic, international level? And maybe how can we make the West a little bit more attractive?
At least we will attempt to do so. It's not going to be easy, but there are certainly, you know, we can certainly dream and we can think of paths that could lead to a better tomorrow, because it's painful to see the Western decline, and it would be good to find some kind of new paths that can maybe will not bring us back to the 1990s, but that will still let the West be a force for good internally as well as externally in the future. Having said that, criticizing the West as we're doing in itself has value, because hopefully some listeners will come up with ideas based on this, right? So if listeners before July have some ideas of how these issues that we're highlighting can actually be solved, please, please send it to us.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on institutional failure and decline in the West. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
This is a quote that in many ways encapsulates the exact danger that the West is in. These past three episodes when we've talked about the institutions, in many ways can all be reduced to the idea of insider versus outsider. And we pretend that outsiders, whether it is at a foreign policy level, China or Russia, or whether it's at a domestic level, liberals versus conservative, or whether it's about migration, people trying to come into our country, that they are the problem, whereas in reality, outsiders are never the reason why society falls in disrepair and decay. Societies decay because of internal weakness, because of how they are dealing with themselves, not because of some evil barbarian on the outside trying to destroy us. And the following quote is one that encapsulates it very nicely. It's by the author Ariel Durant, who wrote, "A great civilization is not conquered from without until it has destroyed itself from within."